Hello, everybody. Welcome to True Crime Predators with me, your host, Kathy Cassidy, and I am a clinical forensic therapist. And today is Sunday morning. Happy Easter to everyone celebrating. So I'm sure anybody who has listened to me knows I'm not a professional podcaster, nor do I pretend to be one. So today I'm getting ready and I thought, well, you're going to do a get ready with me, even though you can't see me, you're going to hear me getting ready. But it's a good way for me to talk and not be so focused on every little word I say and try to tell it like I'm talking to a friend, which is how I try to make all my podcasts. So you're going to hear stuff clinking and clicking and all that. So just pretend you're here and we're chatting, okay? Okay, so today's podcast is about sex offenders and polygraphs, and I just want to explain to you how it worked, at least where I worked, for the Department of Corrections. And I worked for the parole division that was designated to sex offenders. So these were all men, and these were men who have all, they're on parole. So if someone's on parole, they've already served their sentence. They've already been to trial, been convicted, and sentenced to time in prison, the ones that I worked with, okay? So these guys, part of when somebody gets out on parole, they have what's called parole conditions, which are like rules they have to follow once they get out, okay? And most of them, you know, it's like a kind of a template of the rules for sex offenders. I don't know about regular criminals or parolees, I should say. Like regulars and not sex offenders. But sex offenders, basically, there's kind of a template. And when I worked there, the template pretty much consisted of like no alcohol, no drugs, no internet, no streaming services like Netflix, no, none of that. They couldn't have anything. They couldn't have internet on their phones. I'm trying to remember. So all of these are in place in hopes of them not accessing pornography, taking pictures like that would potentially be part of a new crime. So, I mean, there's probably more reasons. That's just what I can think of why those are in place. And then there are some offenders that have certain things tailor-made to them, possibly because of what their sex crimes were. So say someone had a bestiality sex crime, you know, a bunch of crimes against dogs, which I've interviewed one of those. They wouldn't be allowed around animals, where that's not really like part of the template for everybody else. Okay. But one thing that is part, okay. So hang on. Sometimes I get ahead of myself. I try to tell it exactly how it would be to someone who's never worked there. So sometimes I try not to forget stuff so it makes sense to you guys. So part of conditions for sex offenders where I worked, I don't know if this is everywhere, they were court mandated to polygraphs every 6 months. Maybe other places do different time frames. Maybe other places don't do them at all. I'm not sure because that's the only place I worked at this capacity with offenders. So they're meaning every 6 months, once they're enrolled in treatment with us at the parole division through the state, through the Department of Corrections, they had to be preparing for their polygraph. Part of the polygraph that's extremely hard for sex offenders where I was is the cost. So the cost back then, now this is, you know, 2009, 10, 11, 12-ish, was about, I think it was $300. And imagine, you know, that's twice a year if they make it through their parole that long without violating. And, you know, offenders, sex offenders, their parole is extremely rough to live in the regular world. So coming up with $300 twice a year was a lot of times part of why guys would end up having to go back, violate, because they weren't able to pay for a polygraph financially, because sex offenders have an extremely hard time getting work, as you can imagine. When they're on parole, they have to tell their employee that they are a registered sex offender. And their parole agent, the sex offender parole agents, who you guys know I love and respect more than anyone in this field, because they are amazing, and at least the ones I worked with. Everything that I say is just my experiences. And they are trained different. I don't know what is different about their training or how they do it, but they're specifically for sex offenders, and they're so good at it. Not on power trips and not complacent, just really diligent. So, sorry, I keep saying so. They have to have jobs. Well, they're supposed to have jobs. They try to get jobs, but once they get hired somewhere, their parole agents do go to their employers, make sure everything's legitimate, because they also are not allowed to work at a lot of different places. Definitely not a bar, a liquor store, anywhere kids congregate. Like, they couldn't work at like a McDonald's with a Playland. I don't even know if they still have those. They couldn't work at a school, things like that. So the parole agent has to go out, make sure the job is, you know, legitimate for their conditions. They also have to talk to management to make sure that the sex offender has in fact disclosed that they are a sex offender. So there's no getting around that. You can imagine not a lot of places really are interested in hiring a sex offender. It's very hard for them to get work, which means it's very hard for them to find a place to live. And it's very, very hard for them to get to sex offender treatment. And which, because most of them don't have cars, so they have to take the bus, which costs money, and then the polygraph, which costs money, a lot of money for them. And so this is a big problem. Okay, now let's talk about the polygraph. The guys we used when I worked there, we used two different companies. Well, I don't know if they were companies. We used one lady who was, both of them were amazing. I had never been around a polygraph in my life for any reason. This is in the early years. There was an internet like that, like where you could just watch what a polygraph looked like and everything, like how it is now. So I really had no experience. I didn't really know what to expect. I was a little bit, you know, intrigued by the process. Like, what is, you know, you just hook up and they can just magically tell if you're lying. I didn't know anything. Sometimes I feel like I still don't. But okay, so we had the lady. She was young. She was amazing. A young woman who had her own business doing polygraph examinations, very successful, very professional, awesome woman. Then we had, on occasion, I was lucky to know both of them, but I was obviously fascinated by a retired FBI agent that we had once in a while. He was awesome. I loved both of them. He was older, probably, I mean, I'm 52. He's like probably 60, maybe 55. I don't know, right in there. Or maybe he was older since he was retired. I don't know. But he was older and very wise, very professional. But you could see like he had a personality and a wit about him. And both of them were not intimidating, but had this presence that I don't know how to describe it. Very, you knew it was about business, but you could also see they had a personality. So I think that's like a refined skill, to be professional and serious, and for people to also see that you're not a robot. So that's what both of them had. They did not work together. Like I said, the one guy was retired FBI. The other lady just had her own business. She was amazing. Okay, so we would schedule with one of them. We had, you know, a list of whose polygraphs were coming up. This would be a pretty common topic in our sex offender therapy, like whose polygraphs were coming up and were they ready financially? because, again, this is a hot topic. This is a big problem. Most of them, if you guys are wondering, where did they get their money to pay? Usually it fell on the family, the friends, the girlfriends. Because remember, these are all guys. None of them were gay, that I, at least openly. So it would be their girlfriends, their wives, their mothers, sisters, uncles, whoever in their family or friends, usually family, it fell on them to help them out. And the pressure was significant because if they didn't do it, they had a very high, like, at least the threat was you're definitely going back to prison. Sorry. So the pressure, you know, the consequence was very high. So a lot of times, you know, think if you have a son, and that's people say like, oh, I would never talk to my son. Well, I've only known one sex offender in my entire career whose entire family cut them off. And that's my interview with pedophile, the one that's called Grandpa. He is the only offender I've ever known. All friends, all family, completely cut off from everyone, everywhere, other than his attorney. Most offenders, their moms do stand by them. A lot of offenders, their wives stand by them, their girlfriends, or they find new girlfriends. Shocking, but true. Okay, so they would have to come up with this money. And it wasn't easy, even if they had someone who ended up helping them, it still wasn't easy for them to come up with. All right, so say they got the money together. Polygraph day is a little bit of a, you know, a big day for, obviously for them. They're a nervous wreck because I think they're, you know, in all fairness, just to humans, when you know you're taking a polygraph, I would think, at least I would be worried, like, what if my truth came off as a lie? Like, what if I messed it up and they think it's a lie, but it's really the truth? So I don't know if that's how they felt, but I would imagine. Okay, so the point of a polygraph for sex offenders. Part of it, there's one that I can't remember the names. It's like a maintenance polygraph. So it's basically to make sure that they're telling the truth about their crime, which is part of their treatment, is being completely open from the moment they started fantasizing about the crime to the moment they're sitting in that chair in sex offender treatment. And the polygraph can consist of anything in between. And the point of that is to make sure that they're being forthcoming about their crime so that they can take an honest, for lack of a better word, try at treatment. And so that's the point of that. Then the other polygraphs are, say that, then this can happen at any time. If a sex offender in sex offender treatment is suspicious of some behavior that could send them back to prison, such as possibly offending another child, another person, another sex offense, then we could, or their parole agents or us could basically mandate that they have to take another one. Okay, so there were a few different reasons. And then there were polygraphs like that. So which one they were getting, I honestly can't remember how that worked out. Like who's getting the maintenance and who is getting the one to see if they messed up. Okay, here we go. So part of a polygraph, and part of me was like not sure I wanted to even share this, but I'm pretty sure it's already out there. And the only reason I say that is because when people are taking a polygraph, you don't want them to know the tricks and the things behind it so that they can outsmart the polygraph so they can get away with raping more children and people, women and men. That's not the goal. So that was why part of me was like, should I even do this? But I'm pretty positive in 2024, you can find out everything you want to know about everything. So the thing about a polygraph is the examiners, sometimes together, myself or my colleagues and the examiner, or just me or just the examiner, we would come up with the questions for the polygraph because they needed to be pointed towards that offender, what they've been through, what we're suspicious of, things like that. So your questions are not for us. They weren't basic. Not like, have you heard anybody lately? No, it was like, for the one offender I did who liked infants and children and who moved in next to a three-year-old purposely. His polygraph consisted of, you know, did you know that little, did you know there was a three-year-old child living in the building? Something like that. Or did you purposely move into that building because you are planning another victim? So that's just an example of how pointed the questions can be. Now, the real meat of a polygraph is not the actual passing and failing of one. I mean, maybe it has significance. I don't know. You know, you guys know they're not admissible in court. However, they are, they do have a heavy weight in sex offender therapy if you're failing one. But the place that everything really comes out, and this is why being a top-notch polygraph examiner is crucial, it's not in the questions during the polygraph. It's in, there's a whole like hour, 2 hours, depending on what's going on, depending on the examiner, pre-polygraph, where there's very meaningful, very thought out conversation. Meaning the examiner is asking us like what's going on with this guy, you know, and we would say like how they're doing, what we're suspicious of, what they're doing good at, what all the things, right? And then the examiner during the pre-poly, they would talk to them. And because most people are very nervous before a polygraph, which makes very good sense for anybody, a lot would come out in this pre-polygraph. So sometimes that's where you really learn the most about what's going on. So the examiners would say something like, you know, if you tell the truth about what's going on with the neighbor, for example, then when I ask you about it during the exam, it's not going to come up that you failed because you already told me. You see the catch? So there's a lot of disclosure that takes place during that pre-interview. And then it doesn't matter that much whether they passed or failed the poly because they've already disclosed the truth of what's been going on in the pre-interview. So there you have it, guys. That is what's behind the sex offender polygraph. I don't know because I'm not a polygraph examiner. I don't know if that's how it is for all of them everywhere. I have no clue. I only know what I learned from the people who did it, you know, for the Department of Corrections. And I learned, you know, I always try to learn from any other profession and even my peers. Learn as much as you can from everyone you're around, because everyone, even people with the same education or experience as me, everyone has different perceptions, different experiences. You can learn so much. And in my field, at least, people are so awesome about sharing, you know, how they got there, things they've learned, things they've done. And it's fascinating. I mean, my field of work, especially forensics, is to me fascinating. Parole agents, oh my gosh, they had so much information in the way they would do things and the things they would think of. Same with polygraph examiners, who knew that they had to be a skilled master conversationalist. They need to provide, at least ours, that where we were, comfort to a level that people don't feel. If you're intimidated and someone's coming off like a big, arrogant, you know, power tripping, authoritative jerk, people are not going to disclose anything. Your polygraphs are going to be sucky. But if you are like the ones we had, have a really great demeanor, you're not friendly and you're not like a robot. You're just, people feel comfortable talking to you. And again, not like a best friend, but not like you're in trouble and you're going to jail. So it's a very fine line of, and they're not manipulative like how an interrogator is. Like they don't have to use manipulative techniques to a degree, not to that level, but they have, it's just, it's such a skill, and it's fascinating to read the reports and read what they've watched and listen to the recordings. It's fascinating, at least to me. And I'm sure anyone listening to this is probably interested too. It's really interesting. So remember, you guys, like, and maybe that's why they're not admissible in court, because there's a lot of pre-things going on. And that's where it comes out. So interesting, fascinating. So let's say, back to the sex offenders, if they cannot pay for their polygraph, then the parole agent and the parole supervisor, it's, I mean, they're supposed to go back to prison for that, but I have seen situations where they have, and I have seen situations where they haven't. And I'll do another podcast of why sometimes when people get violated, they don't go back to prison. All right, you guys, that was a short one. It's only 20 minutes, but I think, you know, I don't want to just blab on and on just to fill space. All right. I hope you guys got something out of that. Feel free to leave comments in the, what did you think about this portion of the podcast. Also, please subscribe. Please give me a great rating if you loved it. If you hated it, please don't give me a rating. Please don't take me down. All right, guys, you have a beautiful Easter if you're celebrating, and if you're not, have a great Sunday, and I'll be back with more info. All right.